History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And by now we know they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I want to begin this week by wishing a happy 100th birthday to World War II Navy veteran Bob Mettauer, or Bicycle Bob as they know him in Santa Maria, California, where Bob and his friends listen to Hometown Heroes on our affiliate KSMA. Quite a celebration there this weekend for Bob, as Santa Maria also welcomes the Central Coast Air Fest with some of the planes Bob was used to seeing 80 years ago while serving on the aircraft carrier USS Ticonderoga. I wish I could have been there to celebrate with him, but we'll try to catch up soon so we can hear about that big 100th birthday bash. It's wonderful when we see a veteran we met years ago, like Bob, reach that century mark, but the reality we all live with is that every day is a gift, and no day is ever guaranteed for any of us. If you've been listening to Hometown Heroes for any length of time, you know that every veteran has a story, and every one of those stories has meaning. And I do want to thank everybody who waited through a couple hours worth of delays to welcome home that 29th Central Valley Honor Flight. If you aren't dialed in to an Honor Flight group in the area where you're listening today, just go to honorflight.org and find the closest one and reach out. I promise you're not going to regret it. One of the people we're going to focus on today I met through Honor Flight. Another spent a good chunk of his life in flight. And I know it's different for all of us. There are reasons one veteran's story may resonate more deeply with one of you than another. But just in the past couple of weeks came word of the passing of two World War II vets who made really strong impressions on just about everybody who spent even a few moments with them. They were a combined 200 years old, and boy, did they fill those years. Dorothy Jones passed away September 13th, just 10 weeks shy of her 104th birthday. And life as a centenarian was pretty eventful for her, traveling to Normandy and Pearl Harbor with our friends from the Best Defense Foundation, and making as many memories for the people who traveled with her as she did for herself. Dorothy was one of the first women to sign up for military service in the Navy in World War II.
I was born and grew up in South Carolina and was at the very end of the Great Depression. So I know what it's like to be living in a time when jobs were scarce. My father was a barber, and Lord knows, barbers didn't make much money. And there were six of us kids, which gave a pretty... It worked. We were church-going people, but we were also poor as church mice, and that worked fine, too. And then we all grew up.
Well, and, you know, considering that, I imagine your childhood was a little different from the childhood your children had here in Fresno. And maybe you told them a story or two over the years of the chores you had to do or the way you guys had to make do in those Depression years. Anything you want to share with us?
Oh, man. It's a different world completely. And I wonder what the next 100 years is going to bring for the next generation to go into that. Yeah, it was different. We lived, I won't say hand to mouth, but when you learn to live without, because you've never had the types of things that kids have today, thank goodness they have it much better. And I hope they realize it. And I hope they will continue to realize it. Because we grew up with not too much, but every little advancement was a great help. I think of my mother doing all her own work. And as we grew up, we learned what it was like to scrub a floor or wash a window or take out garbage and do all the things that had to be done. And they got done.
I'm thinking about how different the world is, not just for everybody, but specifically for women. Mm-hmm. Young girls today may have different kinds of dreams and ambitions than you had as a young lady there in South Carolina. Do you remember having a dream that, hey, one day this is what I'm going to do with my life or make of myself?
Yeah. I used to think, now this is back in 1920 and 21 and 22, and as I grew up, it got a little older in school, I thought, California. Would I love to see California? It was just as far away as it is going to the moon now, you might say. And gradually you find yourself. I was the first one, actually, in my family who graduated high school. And as things were at that time, that was as far as I dared even hope. I would love to have gone on to college, but I couldn't afford it. Jobs were scarce, but I was able to get a job. I'd taken the commercial courses in high school and was able to type and take shorthand and do that sort of thing. Well, I was 2 years before I even got that job. So once I started working and helping financially at home, then my two older brothers were helping too, and things began to lighten up considerably. And it wasn't until World War II came along that jobs became available. And it's sad to think that, but things were beginning or had been bubbling in Europe for a while. And it was obvious that it wasn't going to stop there. And I continued to go to my little work and type my little typing up and all that sort of thing. I've graduated high school in 1938. Then the war came along into our country, because we knew from the news and things were happening that it was not going to stop there. And when Pearl Harbor came along, I was at the right age and the right temperament to, hey, this is going to go over again, so let's go see what that's all about. And a certain amount of patriotism and a certain amount of curiosity and a certain amount of maybe just plain get out there and see what's happening. And so one day in the Charlotte paper, after I'd been out of high school 4 years, 21 now, there was an article in the paper to the effect that a naval officer would be in Charlotte, which was 25 miles from my hometown, down across the South Carolina line. And by golly, it said, any women between the ages of so-and-so and so-and-so, unencumbered with husbands or children or whatever, could call up and go up and for an interview if you're interested in going into the Navy. Well, hey, that was not an auxiliary thing. It was just like the boys going in. But the reason they needed women to go in, girls to go in then, was to relieve the men who were doing the kinds of jobs that women could do, such as office work. And some of the boys were, I'm sure, happy to get out from under that kind of work and put on a fighting uniform and go and serve aboard ship or to one of our islands. At that time, which we didn't know, the Japanese had armed quite a few of the islands down in the Pacific. And you know it now, we know it now. So we went in, I went to Charlotte, and I passed all the little tests, aptitude tests and health tests and all that sort of thing. And in October of 1942, I left Charlotte and Rock Hill and went to Stillwater, Oklahoma, where they'd taken over a college there as a training base for prospective Navy women. Ha ha! So we were fitted for uniforms and thought we looked. I never thought I would wear anything designed and provided by the main Bouchet stylist, but I did, and we looked good.
And this was a brand new thing. I mean, President Roosevelt only allowed this a few months earlier, so you were a trailblazer. You were one of the first women to sign up for this, and that was such a big deal. They decided to put a picture of you in the paper. Now, this picture here of all these young ladies on the train. I mean, you guys are on the caboose, and here's these sailors saying goodbye to you.
That's what I get from hauling pictures off the wall upstairs and bringing them down here and showing off. Yes, it hadn't happened before. And Mr. Roosevelt, as well as Eleanor Roosevelt, who has always been my ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I had lunch with her one day.
Really?
Yes, I did. Another story, but it's a good story. Anyway, we went up to Charlotte, and we were sworn in right there. It was, as I said, it was October of 1942, which sounds ancient now, doesn't it? That was a long time ago. And away we went to Stillwater, Oklahoma, for 2.5 months or so of training. Mm-hmm. It was training the Navy way of writing letters, the Navy way of setting up your everything. And as I said before, and I'm very proud of this, we were not an auxiliary or a helpful. It was just exactly as the boys were. Of course, they had flocked to the recruiting stations by then, because once Pearl Harbor was attacked, everybody became very patriotic and ready to put on a uniform of some kind and go and protect our country. So there we went. I wonder sometimes, really, what would happen today if we had that same sort of thing to look at today. Mm-hmm. If we had the same sort of love of our country and people were ready to do what they could do. Of course, the women were not trained to carry a gun or shoot a gun. We were not that kind of helpers. We went in to relieve a man so he could go and do that.
So you mentioned the attack on Pearl Harbor. I'm always interested. It seems like everybody has distinct memories of where they were and how they found out about that. Do you have a memory like that?
Indeed, I do. We had just come home from church. Now, this in South Carolina, which the timing was entirely different then. It was over in the early afternoon. My mother and I were in the living room. And my youngest brother had gone in the kitchen to see what he could delve out of the dinner in there before dinner was served. Dinner was at noontime, you know. I'm from the South.
That's not dinner.
Luncheon. Still dinner. So he came into the living room with a puzzled look on his face, and he said, "You know, something strange is happening someplace. There's a place called Pearl Harbor." We had never heard of Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor. And he said, "I think there's a war going on, and it's our soldiers and things." So naturally, we turned on and we got the message right then that Pearl Harbor was being attacked. All the joy kind of went out of our lives for a while because we didn't know where they were going from there. And I don't think they did either. Mm-hmm. I thought of that day and I thought we had so little protection at that time. And they wiped out practically all the Navy we had. All the battleships were there in a row, and they just burned the heck out of them. And there's still people. I've been back there since, of course. But there's still sailors down under that in the Arizona and the other battleships.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't any fun for them. And everything took a change then. We were in the war, and my little job typing away in the office where I'd been. So that's when I saw the ad in the notice in the paper that women would be accepted, and away I went.
And you mentioned six kids in your family.
Yes.
How many of those six ended up serving in the war?
Three of my brothers and myself. Mm-hmm. I had a sister who was married at the time. And then my oldest brother did not serve but the rest of us served different branches. I was in the Navy until my brother, 2 years older than I, who had been, what is it, when you don't pass the, he had a hearing problem.
4F?
4F. Mm-hmm. And oh, that just was the most heartbreaking thing for him. So he was accepted then after I'd been in for 6 months or so. And he came, he was accepted and he served aboard ship. Ran into him in Hawaii when I was stationed there. His ship came into Hawaii. And I got leave and went up and we had a great time getting
Wonderful.
Reacquainted. And a brother who was in the Air Force, and he was in India, and they flew over the hump mm-hmm. there. That youngest brother then, who told a whole bunch of lies and went into the Marine Corps because he wasn't old enough. And he went into the Marine Corps, and of course he was in some of the invasions in some of the islands down there.
So how old was he?
Well, he was 16, but he was going to be 17 eventually. And I guess they wanted, and he was a big, strong boy. He was a football player and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he did well, and he grew up there, you might say.
And they all made it through the war okay?
All made it, and my brother-in-law, the sister I told you about, was married, and her husband had been in the National Guard, and of course he was called up right away.
Mm-hmm.
So we had plenty of stars in the window. At that time, if you had someone in the military that you could put a little star in your window, and my mother's window was pretty much full of stars, but we all got home safely and telling each other a bunch of war stories, and that was fun too. But I was in there almost 4 years.
And I've got to ask you too, since you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt was yeah. someone you looked up to, and she did advocate for women's roles.
Yes.
Another thing that she gained some acclaim for is how she advocated for African Americans to serve.
She did, indeed.
And to fly.
Yes.
Growing up in the South, in Rock Hill, I just mm-hmm. out of curiosity, Were those schools, your high school, would that have been a segregated school?
Much to my sorrow. And when I go back there and see my high school, and it was that way. Mm-hmm. It was that way. But she did, the two of them, mm-hmm. were people of their time. I think the person appears when we need him most. And I think at that time, America needed people like the Roosevelts. And thank heavens they did, because they did.
How were you treated as a woman around all these men? Because 16 million Americans in the armed forces, but only 300,000 of them were women. And
that
you
was
were
great.
One of the first. Good odds or what?
That was super. Yeah. I was not a particularly attractive girl. You wouldn't believe it now. Ha, ha, ha. And I had a rather low, slow coming to grips with dating and going out, and even before the war with this stuff. Mm-hmm. But boy, you're suddenly in war, you're surrounded by guys, and they adored us because they weren't accustomed to women being in the same mess hall. Of course, you didn't share any kind of barracks or that sort of thing. They were very, very separated. And we honored that, and so did the boys. The boys were great. And when they finally, after I was made a recruiter, which was a fun job, mm-hmm. because you drove all over from Atlanta up to Charlotte, across to Knoxville, Tennessee. And it was great.
And she was great. One of my favorite photos of Dorothy is of her soaking up the adulation of a sold-out Fresno State football game when she was honored as the hero of the game. It's time for our first break, but we'll revisit more of Dorothy Jones' World War II memories, including the time she got to meet the First Lady. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute episode honoring two of your favorite heroes you've listened to here on the radio over the years. We're going to honor a legendary Air Force general shortly, but we've gone ladies first today, as Dorothy Jones would have expected. She passed away September 13th at the age of 103, but 80 years earlier, as one of the first women to join the WAVES, Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency Service in the Navy, opportunity knocked while she was assigned as a recruiter.
So I did that until another little notice came out in our own directives saying that women who are interested in applying for transfer to Hawaii. Now, at that time, Hawaii was not a state. Mm-hmm. It was a territory. And when this little notice appeared, I'm a great one for reading things in the newspaper and going after them. So there's women who were interested in applying for duty in Hawaii, and I did indeed apply for the Hawaiian thing. And then I was sent out here for the necessary training again to go there and get the certain shots that were inoculations to keep us healthy.
So you finally got to see California, which you
I spent not as much of it as I planned to or wanted to. Yeah, I did get my desire to come to California, and of course our traveling was done on trains or buses because they were not flying people all over like they do today. Mm-hmm. You were strictly on a train, and for the first time I slept on a sleeper in a Pullman train. that was an experience in itself, you know. So whatever comes along new brings its own different experiences, and you learn to take advantage of them. So I loved it. And then to Hawaii, and of course, that's next thing to going to heaven, or to Charleston, South Carolina. It's a nice place to be. Mm-hmm. And I was stationed down on the big island of Hawaii. It was a place, if I'd had a lick of sense, I would have invested my simple little Navy pay in some property there and had a little place to go when I'd want to now. Where I was stationed is a big golf course.
And what were you doing there?
I was the secretary. By this time, I'd done enough office work that I was quite proficient in what I was doing. And I was secretary to the OD, the officer of the day. My office was right where you'd come into the administrative office's doors, and everybody had to check by and look at their little ID and be sure they were all right, not our enemies. And that was fun. And I met the nicest people in the world, both in the Navy training, the girls, the women that were in there, because we had eliminated all those that we were told, if somebody comes during the recruiting thing. If somebody applies and you talk to them and you give them the test and you check their credentials and all that, if it's somebody you would not like or enjoy being stationed with or being roomed with or whatever, there's lots of ways they can be eliminated. And I must say I did put some of them on my own elimination, because if there's somebody you don't want to spend 24 hours a day with and you can get them off your list, you do it. And I did. And I'm glad. You learn that sometimes you're not the real controller of where you'll be today and tomorrow and the next day. And you learn to accept it and go as you are. But again, as I've said before, and I will continue to think that, it was just the personnel that got away from that small town of Rock Hill, which was a nice little town. I'm not putting it down. But to room with people, one of my roommates was from Lake of the Woods, Minnesota. And she was such a nice gal. And we learned from each other. We learned what our own backgrounds had been and where we'll meet later after the war, because we didn't know how long that war was going to go on. And we didn't know. And, of course, as soon as it was finished, as soon as the European war and then the Japanese war was finished, the government started trying to get their people home, because that was expensive, flying those people all those years. And in no time at all, I was on a train going back to Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I worked for the VA there. We were just opening a Veterans Administration office in Rock Hill. And boy, that's when we learned what some of the veterans had gone through. It wasn't all peaches and cream for some of them, because they would come into our VA office and we helped where we could there with whatever their problems were, whether they were medical or insurance-wise or educational-wise. There were tons and tons of opportunities for veterans right after the war. And there still are, really.
I was just thinking about what you said earlier about your mother had so many stars in the window, you could barely see through the window. And one of those was for you. And I'm wondering if you got a sense for how she felt about that. Because everybody's sons were going off to war. But to have her daughter, you know, what, 5,000 miles away in Hawaii from South Carolina, how does she feel about that?
Well, I know, especially from talking to her afterwards, that she would have preferred that I stay at home and keep my little job going at the printing and finishing company, where we were taking care of cloth made out of cotton that was grown right there. She took a rather dim view at first, because she didn't know exactly what I was going into, and I didn't either. But she had a certain amount of daring do about her, too, and she accepted what came along. Yeah, she was pretty proud of all her in-service family.
You know, you mentioned that when you got home and you worked at the VA, that you really saw what some of the guys had gone through. But I'm wondering, in those years, while the war's going on and you're in uniform, what was your perspective about what you were doing and why it mattered? Maybe the significance of the work that you were doing.
Well, we did realize that we were an important part of the overall picture. Because as more and more women did come into the military, we realized that we were there primarily to release, and this was it true, to release a man for duties that we could not perform and would not be asked to. Mm-hmm. That's why when I look at the women going into the military now, I wonder what their object is and where they came from and where they're going. I did spend a lot, some time down at Lemoore Naval Air Base here when my husband was still with us, and I would see more and more girls going into, and some of the things we were very particular about, the length of our hair. And my goodness, we had to walk around the room a dozen times so they could check, the ones in charge could check the length of our skirts. At that time, we were not wearing slacks and, like I'm wearing today, slacks and pants. We were strictly in those uniforms, and they had to be the same distance from the floor. They measured right up, and if they were too long, another fourth of an inch would do it, you know. And it was such a difference, and I see the girls down there now, and they've got a pin to hold their hair up off their neck. But no, they were the first group. That's the first group that had done that, so we marched a pretty straight line, as you say.
You mentioned, you were in Hilo when mm-hmm. the war ended. Yeah. Was that cause for celebration? Was there a big reaction to that news?
Oh, golly. Oh, yes. Of course, we hadn't been in any danger out there for some time. And we had our little social life. There was dances on the base, and a girl who had been a professional musician sang at these things. When that came across on the news, it caused a lot of hooray, hooray, we're going home type of thing. Because mm-hmm. when people have been away from home, even a little town like Rock Hill, South Carolina, it's good to go back home and find that things are like you left them, and maybe you had something to do with it, or maybe you didn't. And most of the kids that were my age when I left had gotten married, and my gosh, had started families and all that sort of thing. And that's when I made the decision to further it by going on further with some kind of interesting life and meeting Shannon and deciding to get married and be a normal human being again.
Now, you said earlier that you got to eat lunch with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, that was when I was recruiting back in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Running around there.
So the war's still going on?
Oh, yeah. This is back before the Hawaiian thing or anything.
All right.
And I was going around there near Asheville, Asheville, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
beautiful town. And so I was near there, and she was coming there to speak to all the men's clubs presidents. There's a lot of you men having your clubs, you know that? Oh, wow. And so since she was going to be there, she would go in a little group of maybe two cars and driving all around those mountains and whatever. And so whoever was planning that luncheon for her found out that I was the only woman in uniform, the only wave there. There were nurses and all that. But I was invited to come to this luncheon. So heck, if Mrs. Roosevelt was going to walk across the floor, I was going to see her walk. And I went, and she told that she was not particularly pretty, if you remember. So she told this story about herself. She said she was up right outside of town here, not too far in the country, driving through, and there was a house, not the most elaborate looking home, but children were all over and they were waving as she drove by. So she had them stop, and she went up to talk with the people of color who lived there. And when she went in, she saw that the rooms were all papered with newspaper. What they would do is make wallpaper from newspapers, and they would make a goopy paste with flour and water, and that for warmth. That would keep that was served as wallpaper, and it warmed the house, and it also gave them a cover over whatever the thing was later. And there was her picture was there from the newspaper, plastered on the wall. And after they had visited a while, Mrs. Roosevelt said, I commented to the lady of the house. I said, well, I'm flattered. I see you have my picture here on your wall. And she spoke in the vernacular. She spoke as they did when she would tell this story. She said, so the lady said to me, yes'm. She says, I tell these young'uns, if they don't stop sucking their thumbs, their mouths going to look just like that. And I love that, how any woman could stand up there and tell a story like that to this group of men and got, they loved her. They loved her. Of course, I loved her before I ever went. And that's what I like to say, that I had lunch with Mrs. Roosevelt. She was sitting in the very center of this head table, and I was several people, maybe 10 or 12 or so, down the line from her. Mm-hmm. But by golly, I had lunch with Mrs. Roosevelt. So there. You can't argue that for a minute. She left her husband at home that day. If there's such a thing as having a hero, and I've gotten so many notes from these honor flight people. Uh-huh. Some of the family members or the people themselves are saying, you are my hero. Because I was in the first group that went, and we kind of plowed the ground, I guess, for the ones that would come along later. Mm-hmm. But it worked. They liked it. They liked us. And now, like I said earlier, I don't think I would be that keen on going if you weren't needed, if it were not wartime, if there were not a certain amount of patriotism and knowing you're needed, what your work is. But golly, we send a woman to be the new vice president of the country. There's no limit to what women can do. And I think that was one of the things that broke the door open for them.
And that makes me wonder. I didn't ask you this. Anytime you're the first to do something, mm-hmm. There are some people who don't think you should be doing it or you mm-hmm. could do it. Mm-hmm. Did you hear any of that negativity or the doubters or the skepticism about what all you ladies were doing?
Very rarely, but occasionally there were. They would come from people. One fellow, he was a Navy chief, and he was in Charleston, in my favorite town. And he said, there's no place in here for the women. Send those women back. Let them work in the hospitals and stuff. He says, we don't need women. And of course, he was voted down right away. And I had a cousin on my mother's side. He didn't see any reason at all for women to go into the military. So he's not my favorite person anymore.
Have you ever thought about how different your life might have been if you had not joined the Navy?
I have. I have indeed. I would probably be living in the same little town, going with the boy who I had dated. I was not much of a dater, like I said earlier, but this boy who had been captain of the football team, I had a real soft spot in my heart for him, but he didn't know I existed. But there were a few who did. So I probably would have married somebody, being right there in that same little town, going to the same little church, which was a good church, the Park Avenue Church, doing their summer program for the children. But I feel like I've seen some of the world. I've been to 38 countries. And I think anybody who can, when the opportunity arises, they should make the opportunity to see as much of the world as you can.
None of your children were alive during World War II.
Oh, no.
I wasn't alive. Most of the people listening weren't alive.
Most of you were not.
So what is it that all of us need to understand about what happened then? Why does it still matter?
You don't have to be a veteran to love the country and want the best for the country and for those that come along. I don't know. Being raised by going to church and learning what you learn in church and applying it to the rest of your life, to school and whatever you do with your life afterward. We've been lucky. We've been fortunate. I tell you what, up in my bedroom, there's somewhat like that one over your head, a little crack in the ceiling. Mm-hmm. The train runs back and it cracks the ceiling from time to time. It's a little crack. And when I go to bed tonight, I lie there and I have my conversation with God. And we talk about things. I treasure that little crack in the ceiling. It gives me an opportunity to not do the repeating thing, but when things go a little beyond what I can safely handle, we talk it over. I am most grateful and most thankful for the four children I have. They're wonderful. You don't take anything for granted.
She didn't, so maybe we shouldn't either. What a blessing it was to know Dorothy Jones and call her friend. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we remember another member of the Greatest Generation who would go on to fly over 500 missions in Korea and Vietnam. He'll be laid to rest on Monday, September 23rd. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes today, and a special tribute episode honoring two inimitable veterans who were kind enough to share some of their stories on this platform. On Monday, September 23rd, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a legendary Air Force general will be laid to rest at the cemetery on the grounds of the United States Air Force Academy. Before becoming a highly decorated pilot, Robert Titus began his military career as a young paratrooper during World War II.
I went through jump school, and I ended up in the 82nd Airborne Division. The war ended while I was in training. The 82nd had redeployed from Europe to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and I marched in the World War II Victory Parade, never having heard a shot fired or been overseas. The 82nd was the World War II Victory Parade from Washington Square in New York all the way up to Central Park. Great event.
Well, those are some memories for you. Speaking of memories, how about December 7th, 1941? Were you in Norfolk that day?
I was. We were walking. I and a couple of my buddies were walking along and heard about it on the radio, I suppose, and we were talking about how we were going to beat the Japs and so on. We walked by an apartment building, and a woman opened a window and said, "You boys don't understand what war is all about. This is not interesting. This is not a good thing." And we were chagrined, I guess, by our immaturity. But, you know, we were fired up because, as all young men, think there's some glorious opportunity in a war. Little did we know.
Well, you have perspective on multiple wars now, but you mentioned marching in that victory parade, and that had to be quite a sight. I mean, to see the people lined up on the streets of New York, I can't imagine how unique that was. Was there some disappointment on your part that you didn't get to go overseas and be a part of it?
Well, I was looking forward to it. In fact, at Fort Bragg, we were lining up to, before I went, the 82nd came back, before the war ended, we were in advanced airborne training in the Alabama area of Fort Benning. They were forming up a new airborne division, presumably to jump into Japan. And I recall, again, on the radio, hearing about the atomic bombs going off, and figured, that's probably a better deal. I don't know that I would have enjoyed jumping into combat in Japan.
Well, Ed, you have perspective from what you did in Korea and Vietnam and time in the Pentagon and at the highest levels of our military. But when you look back on that, do you feel that the atomic bomb and President Truman's decision saved your life?
I can't say that I ever gave it any consideration. Had the opportunity presented itself, I'd have been happy to go with the troopers, I suppose, and engage in combat and try to win the war. That's what we were being trained to do, and I don't think that very many of us were anxious to go or uninterested, but, you know, we'd have done what we were told to do.
Well, and I guess you didn't
know at the time either that eventually you would have the chance to come down behind enemy lines and fight your way back across. Not that that's what your plan was.
No.
How did you go from 82nd Airborne to Air Force pilot?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I went to Virginia Tech to study engineering. I was ready to get out of there. I met an Air Force recruiter, and he said, "We're looking for pilots." And they offered me an opportunity to go to pilot training. Okay, if I could pass the physical. I said, "What's the deal?" They said, "Well, we're looking for pilots. We'll put you into pilot training. If you make it, we'll keep you and give you a commission. And if you don't, we don't want you." And I thought, my goodness, this is a no-brainer for me. You're going to teach me to fly, and if I flunk out, I just go home. No charge, no commitment. I'll sign up. And that's what happened. I went through pilot training and was commissioned and got my wings. And shortly thereafter, they gave a war for me, as I saw it.
How did you receive that news of war?
I was in New York. I had flown up there in a P-51 Mustang to meet a girl that I knew. And the following Sunday, I was ready to leave town. And I was headed out to Floyd Bennett Field, where I parked the airplane. And I heard the news that the war started in Korea. And I was anxious to get involved. And I kept applying. It took me about a year before they finally, I was essential where I was told. We were flying Mustangs and making blips for a radar controller school down at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. I kept going over to personnel saying, "I want to sign up for an assignment in the war." Well, finally, a year or so later, I got orders to go to Luke Field and shoot a little gunnery and then head over to Korea. As it turned out, I got waylaid and sent to Japan for about 3 months. And again, I was still trying to get into the war in Korea, and I kept contacting friends of mine over there. And finally, a fellow by the name of Rock Brett, who was the ops officer of one of the fighter squadrons, went to his group commander, who in turn put in a name request for me. As a result of that, I got called in by the colonel, who my group commander, and told me that I was going out of channels, and that was totally unauthorized and unacceptable. He said, "However, you've got the group gunnery records. Maybe you can do some good over there, so I'm going to let you go."
Why was that so important to you? Why did you so doggedly pursue that assignment?
I had in my blood the image of myself as a fighter pilot, and fighter pilots do what they do in war. And as I said, when I was a kid, I read lots of books, G8 and His Battle Aces and Eddie Rickenbacker, Fighting the Flying Circus, and I just felt that's where I should be. As long as there was a war and I was a pilot and I was a fighter pilot and what I considered to be a pretty good fighter pilot, I wanted to be involved. I thought that was my job.
And you have flown most of the fighter aircraft that the Air Force has had. Are you still kind of partial to that Mustang?
Oh, yeah. As I tell my good friend up in Denver, who's a tax attorney and owns a Mustang and races at Reno, he also owns a Sea Fury, and he asked me one time what I thought of the Mustang, and I told him, what else can you think of about it when you understand it's the best airplane that God ever allowed to be built? Yeah, it's a great airplane, and that and the Sabre jet were my favorite.
Well, and you flew them both in Korea, 101 combat missions in Korea. Did I have that number right?
So I understand. I didn't pay much attention, but they told me you already flew 100 and you got to go home.
What kind of missions were those? I mean, that's a lot. That's
flying the Mustangs, it was mostly ground support and interdiction, flying up the main supply routes, looking for trucks or anything coming down into the battle area to keep the supplies from the enemy getting to the front, and a lot of close air support. For the Army on the ground and the Marines, dropping bombs and napalm and strafing to assist our comrades on the grounds. And a very noble mission. Close support is a very fine mission because you work so close to the troops, we used to say. The 40s and 50s will get you in the coolant, and then the day's over.
How did you handle that, the pressure and precision that those kind of missions required?
You know, you just get yourself, your teeth into it, as it were. You're so intent on providing the best support you can and keeping the enemy suppressed and their fire suppressed, that you just get into it. It's like when you're playing football. You get into the game, and you're just one with the environment. You just get yourself so heavily involved in it that you haven't got anything else better to do. You just want to do the best you possibly can. You know, sometimes you get butterflies in your belly on the way to the target, but when you get to where you're, when you get into the hostile environment, again, you're so busy, you're so involved, you haven't got time to think about your own personal welfare. It's just not within the equation of your thought process.
And you had targets, but you were a target. How frequent was anti-aircraft fire from the ground or maybe even enemy fighters?
Well, no enemy fighters when we were flying Mustangs down at the, they were too far away. There were some that had occasionally been involved with that activity before the stabilized the demilitarized zone as it was when I was there. So there was no evidence or any indication of enemy aircraft activity, but there was an awful lot of ground fire. And I got hit quite a few times. Every time I bring the airplane home, the sergeant would be looking at it, and he'd look at me and say, "You got my airplane, holding my airplane again, sir." And say, "Sorry about that."
Did that ever get to you? The holes in the airplane? Realizing how many there were or where they were and how close you came to being shot down?
I remember one incident where I felt the blast of some kind of a projectile, and the airplane bounced, and I smelled cordite, and I thought, I'm done. And I called my wingman and said, I'm hit, and I'm headed out. And I looked at all my instruments. Everything was fine. I thought, what in the world is this? I had some rockets on board, and I thought, well, I'm going back and shoot up that target again. And I did, but apparently there's no damage to the airplane. It's the strangest thing. Only experience I ever had like that. You know, it startled me.
Sure.
You know, trying to sort out what I was going to do. I wasn't terrified of anything, as I recall. When you get it, you have to bail out, then you do that too.
Did you ever have to do that in the 51?
Yeah, I got hit, and I didn't realize I was hit until the engine started heating up. Obviously, the coolant had leaked out, and had gone and hit the peg, and the airplane started to burn, and I was forced to bail out. I just went out over the edge, and I was a lot lower than I thought I was, apparently, because I pulled the ripcord and the parachute opened and I hit the ground almost all at once. I didn't know where I was. Nobody else saw me bail out. They thought I was gone when I got home. I didn't show up. Anyway, it turns out I was in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, and I was between the enemy and the friendly forces in this no man's zone. I tried to orient myself and looked up, and there were guys from the north coming toward me, guys in quilted pajamas, and I thought, they're not the right kind of guys for me. I had my .45, and I fired a couple of shots, and then I heard a burp gun or two, and I thought, whoa, this is not too good. So I hunkered down in the hole, and then wasn't a short time later, I heard a voice that said, keep your head down and crawl this way. A good American voice. The Marines sent out a patrol, laid down suppressing, covering fire, and I crawled over and ended up in a bunker and hitchhiked my way home.
Wow. So all these times that you've been there for the ground forces, now they're here for you.
Yeah, they saw me. The airplane crashed and the parachute opened when we hit the ground. They said, boy, that was close. You almost didn't make it. I said, well, almost is not good enough, is it?
Wow.
I got home. The main supply route where they delivered ordnance and supplies to the front lines ran right through my base, K-46. It wasn't very far south of there. And I got home and the guys already, I said, okay, who's got my shaving brush? They already divvied up my stuff.
Were you able to get it all back?
Yeah.
Did that experience change your perspective after that on future missions?
I can't say that had anything to do with it. I mean, I simply accept it. I've been accused all my life of having a very level personality. I never get too excited about anything. I've been asked many times, what's the best job in the Air Force? And I said, squadron commander of a fighter squadron in combat. So I was able to command the Scotia Tiger outfit, and then I extended so I could fly Phantoms north.
Yeah. And you flew 400 combat missions in Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. 400 and some. I don't know how many, to tell you the truth. Some of them I didn't think were worth counting.
That's an eye-popping number.
More if they'd let me.
I know you would. But just, I mean, when you step back and think about the odds, I mean, you've already survived over 100 missions in Korea, crazy stuff as a test pilot, 400 missions in Vietnam, taking your life into your hand every time.
Well, that's not my call.
You really did enjoy that work.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's the cutting edge of the sword. You're where it is. Serratius at the bridge. It's being there.
If you have 400 of them, there's no one that's typical. But can you give us a taste of what some of those missions were about or like?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's hard to go back. And of course, shooting down that first MiG-21 was a great experience. We were escorting some F-105s down what is called Thud Ridge. It's a mountain ridge that runs northwest to southeast right into Hanoi. We were airborne, and I saw a MiG, and I broke off and announced that I was engaging a MiG. He was in a descending turn to the left, and there was mountains in the background. And so the Sidewinders, which are a heat-seeking missile, were not valid at that date and time because of too much background radiation. So I hooked up with a radar homing missile. Now, that was an AIM-7 Sparrow missile, and you'd lock onto the target and transmit information to the missile, and the missile then would guide to the target. However, I fired the first missile, and it didn't guide. I never saw it, and my backseat is saying, fire another one. I fired another one, and it too didn't guide. And I thought I was going to ram this guy. But finally, the third missile hit him in the wing root, and he ejected. And I was amazed that he had what looked like a Martin Baker seat, an ejection seat. I thought, how about it? It's got the same kind of a ejection seat system that we have. So I was kind of pumped on that.
Yeah, was that kind of a watershed moment for you? Here you'd been in combat in a P-51. You'd been in the F-86 and never had that experience of going toe-to-toe with an enemy fighter like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a thrill because, again, I'd been wanting to shoot down an airplane since I was a kid.
Yeah, well, and there you did. But shooting down two in the same mission is bigger than shooting down one, and you received the Air Force Cross. The only thing higher that you could have gotten is the Medal of Honor. I mean, this is a prestigious, prestigious medal. May 22nd, 1967. It sounds like maybe that same route that you just talked about, huh?
Essentially, yeah. This time I was taking a flight of eight in to provide cover, and we're heading east toward the target area, as I recall, probably about 16, 17,000 feet in position to look at the box of F-105s. And I don't recall, there were 12 or so of them, three flights of four, as I recall. In any event, there were a couple of instances. I saw a flash out to the sunlight reflecting off other aircraft, obviously, out to my 1 o'clock position, and they went off to the right, and I followed them for a while, and I determined that they were no longer a threat to the strike force, so I was concerned about being in position over the flight, protecting the strike force, so I went back to where I should have been, and I called for a jettison of the external tanks, because I'm figuring, okay, the MiGs are up and they're engaging. I looked over my shoulder, and I saw two MiGs coming up our 6 o'clock position, and they were firing missiles, and I called for a break, went a hard left turn, and then as the MiGs went by, I reversed, and the one went up. I saw the one, I put my pipper on him in the gun sight and got a good growling tone from a Sidewinder missile and released the Sidewinder missile. And it flew right up his tailpipe. He exploded. And then I looked out, and here's another MiG at my 1 o'clock position. So I headed for him, and he then made a hard diving turn, and we went through a series of, this time I had a 61 millimeter gun pod, but I had no computing sight. All I had was a pipper. Anyway, when he finally had to roll out, I put my pipper in front of him and just pulled the trigger and hosed him down the center, and he conveniently crashed. So that was the second one. That's how it was.
Well, here's what the Air Force said about it. They said, the President of the United States of America takes pleasure in presenting the Air Force Cross to Lieutenant Colonel Robert F. Titus for extraordinary heroism in military operations against an opposing armed force as an F-4C mission commander in the 389th Tactical Fighter Squadron, 366th Tactical Fighter Wing, Da Nang Air Base, Vietnam, in action near Hanoi, North Vietnam, on 22 May 1967. On that date, Colonel Titus led his flight into one of the most heavily defended areas of North Vietnam in direct support of F-105 strike aircraft operations. Undaunted by accurate flak and five surface-to-air missiles that were launched at his aircraft, he repeatedly and unhesitatingly engaged numerous MiG-21s in defense of the friendly aircraft. During these aggressive and courageous aerial encounters, Colonel Titus destroyed two MiG-21 aircraft. As a direct result of his tenacity and extreme bravery in the face of great danger, the F-105 force was able to accomplish its assigned mission. Through his extraordinary heroism, superb airmanship, and aggressiveness in the face of hostile forces, Lieutenant Colonel Titus reflected the highest credit upon himself and the United States Air Force. How's that sound?
Sounds a little inflated, don't you think?
Well, you tell me. You didn't say anything about the five surface-to-air missiles launched at your plane.
Well, I was vaguely aware of their presence, but I couldn't concern myself with them. I was occupied with the enemy fighter.
How close do you think they came to you?
I have no idea. There was a lot of flak, I know that. But, again, I was not interested in the flak. My wingman said later, he said, all I can think is I'm watching my squadron commander get shot down. But, you know, my job was to get the MiG.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't he saying that because that was probably the likely outcome of the situation you found yourself in?
It's probably close.
And it would have been probably not just you shot down, but some of those F-105 shot down.
Could have been.
So that incident, you're awarded the Air Force Cross for. Do you take some pride in that? Was it a proud moment when they pinned it on you?
You know, the only thing I can say about combat decorations is that as I told somebody earlier some years ago, they decorate you for things that you don't think are particularly significant, and the things that you thought were really spectacular that you accomplished, no one noticed.
And you can read about some of those moments in the book Earthquake. That was General Titus's call sign. It's written by Bill Scott. I have that book linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and I'm so thankful General Titus was convinced to participate in that project, because that book just came out earlier this year, about 5 months before he passed away September 8th at the age of 97. I had a chance to chat with him about the book on my last visit to Colorado Springs.
What I infer from the book, what's contained in it, and your approach to it, is that as reluctant as you were, you hope that if the pilots and leaders of the future read this, there's something that they can use to chart their own course that can have a positive impact on their future. Is there a piece of advice or a principle that from your view is paramount?
Very simple. It's in the book. Duty is the most sublime word in the English language. No one can do more. No one should ever expect to do less. So that was my guiding principle. That and the support of my guardian angel.
Is there anything else you want to say about the book or anything else in general?
Well, to follow up on your previous remark, there are numbers of people who said to me, well, it's important. The book is important for the purpose that you suggested, to set an example for those who are coming up through the system. Officers who are now being commissioned are going to have increasing responsibility, accept that responsibility, and perform in the best interest of the nation and in the service. That's what they're sworn to do, and that's what they should do, and that's what's expected of them. And to the extent they do that, we're a much better blessed nation.
The late General Robert Earthquake Titus, who even took singing lessons in his 90s to sing in his church choir. Quite a voice, quite a story. Quite a man. Our thoughts and prayers are with his wife, Anna Marie, and family, as they are with the children of Dorothy Jones. Listening to the memories of these two very special members of our greatest generation brought back some special memories for me today, and I trust they touched your heart, too. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.